Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome to Live Well Anyway. I'm your host, Mackenzie Coppa. On this podcast, we journey together in learning how to feel healthy, look good, and plan lives we actually like in the midst of all the everyday chaos. I'm so glad you're here. And on today's episode, I have Scott H. Young, and we are talking all about learning. How to learn anything, how to prep for tests and that sort of thing. I really dive into that because I have kids who are in a lot of testing right now, and my senior trying to learn things and cram in a lot of information, how to do that best. We go over all of that in this episode with Scott. We also talk about brain longevity and learning and staying fresh as we're getting older. I think it's a really interesting episode, and I hope that you find it really interesting too. But before we get there, I want to mention a couple of things. So, one thing is very fun. I would love for you to come over and join me on Flown.com. So I just recently became a Flown facilitator, and it is a co-working space where you can show up to a call and we go into deep dive mode. So you can go to an hour-long session or a two-hour-long session. We also have takeoffs where you can just get your planning done, do a little bit of journaling, have some meditation. There's all kinds of things that we have to offer over on flown.com, and I get to be one of the facilitators. So if you go over and look at the calendar, you can see when I am scheduled to be facilitating different sessions. All the facilitators are amazing, but of course I would love to see you in one of my sessions. So if you head over to flown.com, you can get 30 days free to try out the service, see if it helps you to get things done. There's so many different ways that you can use Flown, everything from like buckling down and doing your cleaning around your house, to getting stuff done on your computer, to doing your planning. You could even do your meal planning in the middle of a Flown session. There are so many different ways that you can use it. It is structured really well and based on a lot of great deep work science. I'm kind of geeking out about it these days. I'm so in love with what Flown has to offer, and I'm so excited to be facilitating over there. So I would love to see you. Make sure that you say hi. Let me know if you are a podcast listener when you pop into the room. I would love to be able to personally say hi to you and have you over in that space. Also, another great way to connect with me for as little as one cup of coffee a month is to come over to Patreon. I do 3 live videos over there every week. We do everything from favorite nail polish colors to talking about colostrum to deep diving on planning goods and all that stuff. I would love to see you over there. There's a lot of interaction with the ladies in that community, and I would love to have you join us for as little as $5 a month. So come over to patreon.com/livewelltogether to join us over there, and I hope to see you soon and get to know you better. All right, without further ado, let's dive into this episode with Scott H. Young. Welcome, Scott.
Oh, it's great to be here.
I am so looking forward to having you on today. I think it is the perfect time to be having you on. When this came across, I was like, ooh, that's a good back to school episode, because a lot of us, like my oldest is going to be a senior this year. I have teenagers. I am trying to help them with their study skills and learning things. Mm-hmm. Plus, I'm taking on a lot of new jobs and responsibilities and stuff right now. So I feel like I am steeped in this, like trying to get better at stuff. So when I saw your book come across, I was like, oh, yes, I need all the help that I can get. But as we're getting rolling, would you like to introduce yourself to my audience?
Sure, yeah. So I'm an author. I've written 2 books, Ultra Learning, which came out in 2019. It was a Wall Street Journal bestselling book. And that one was sort of documenting some of my intensive learning projects, as well as the sort of philosophy of what I call Ultra Learning, which is these sort of aggressive, intensive, self-directed learning projects. And then more recently, this book that you mentioned, Get Better at Anything, which is sort of a deep dive into the science of how we learn and how we can do it better. And my own background, my own history, I've basically been writing about learning online for about 2 decades. So very, very early in the days when there weren't that many people writing online, that's how I kind of got my start. And I built a following of people who were interested in some of the ideas I was sharing and some of the projects I was doing. And and now that's been what I've been doing full time for quite some time. So it's been really exciting for me because I feel like when you make your career about learning, you're always encountering new things. So it never stays. Yeah. It's never boring, never stale.
Yeah. And it's such an interesting niche to be in, to be able to have been steeped in learning how to learn for 2 decades. Like that's so, it's very specific. What attracted you to learning about learning?
Yeah, it's always funny reflecting on someone's origin stories because you start to notice things that maybe you didn't really think about at the time, but then you're kind of like, oh, yeah, actually, that does make sense. So both of my parents were elementary school teachers when I was growing up. So I think, you know, just that's already a little bit of an unusual background that nudges one toward learning. And then when I was in high school, when I was getting into college, I had a real sort of interest in not just personal development, but learning in general. So, you know, buying like science books, buying things from the bookstore to learn about lots of different topics. And so I think it's kind of always been in the background. I've just been very fortunate that I found a way to, you know, make a living doing this because obviously it's not the typical profession, but I'm really grateful for the people who, you know, support me by reading my books and doing things like that, that I can actually spend all my time learning about learning and learning different things for the purpose of, you know, figuring out how it works.
Yeah, you were just saying before you came, or before we started, that your next podcast is in Spanish. I was like, oh, my word. Yeah, that would require some learning, I think.
Yeah, yeah. That one, I'm not sure. We'll see how it goes. That one, I haven't spoken Spanish in about 2 years, so we'll see. It'll be a little bit of a, we'll be like shifting right into fifth gear right there for that one.
Yeah, this is going to be a really good evidence podcast to how well.
Yes. We'll see.
This learning's been working. Well, I want to get into some of the ideas in your book because some of it I felt like was a little countercultural to what we have thought. Like one of the topics that you brought up was that brain training doesn't really work the way that we thought it did. So would you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think a lot of people, they make their decisions about what they're going to do on the power of analogies. And so we have these sort of simple analogies for things in our life. And when they work well, they work really well. And so, you know, if you have an analogy of like exercise and this idea that, well, you need to like strengthen your muscles, you need to like put them under strain in order for them to grow, I think most people understand and appreciate that analogy. And I think it's very natural to extend that to the mind, this idea that we're going to do some sort of strenuous mental activity. So I remember there was a while, I think they had to stop doing it, but there was the while that Lumosity was had all those ads on the sidebar of every website you'd visit being like, you know, stave off Alzheimer's and dementia by doing these brain training games.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that when you actually dig into the research, that doesn't appear to be the case. That it doesn't appear to be the case that doing this kind of strenuous mental activity improves the brain as a whole. So it is definitely the case that when you practice something, you get good at what you practice. And if the thing that you practice has some similarities to something else that you're doing, so if you learn, you know, math in a math class and then you take a physics class, well, there's a lot of the pieces that are the same, so you get some benefit. But it doesn't appear to be the case that, you know, if you learn some math and you get really, really good at it, that it just enhances your brain function for lots of other things. And so this is kind of a disappointing thing. Like it would be nice if the brain worked that way. But I think it's also useful because when you see how a particular analogy is wrong, you can replace it with a better one. And so I think the better analogy for how the mind works is you have to think of it like it's a toolbox with lots of different tools. And so the key to having, you know, wide-ranging intelligence, critical thinking, smarts, problem-solving skills is to have a lot of tools in that toolbox, to have seen a lot of examples, to have seen lots of material, to really be someone who learns a lot about lots of different subjects. And so I think that's a better model for, you know, when we're talking to our kids and telling them why to learn things is because we're trying to expand that toolkit. It's also important for ourselves because I think sometimes there's something tempting about the idea that like, well, if I just like just focus on doing these crossword puzzles, I'm gonna like keep my mind sharp. But really, you need to be doing something broader than that. You need to be getting lots of different skills, lots of different practice if you want to have that, you know, cognitive reserve into your old age.
Yeah, it's so interesting that you bring that one up specifically, because my great grandmother, she would read and she would do crossword puzzles. And she had like stacks of notebooks where she would write down all the different words, like random words that she, and she was good at it. But nonetheless, she ended up getting Alzheimer's and really had that decline. And so it was like we all thought like, oh, she's doing the work, she's doing the stuff, but then it didn't in the end have those results. And so it's like I've known that for 20 years now since she passed, but when you put it in that light, it was like, oh yeah, it's that idea that you talk about in the book, that we always hear br the brain is a muscle, but that really it's not.
Well, so I think it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that the state of Alzheimer's research is that there like aren't good treatments. And I mean, we know that exercising, being generally keeping the body healthy, is good for Alzheimer's because the brain is part of the body. So just the same way that, you know, if you imagine that being healthy would be good for your liver, it's also good for your brain. So that's one thing you can do. And it isn't the case that there's no benefit to learning things for as you get older, because there's this concept called cognitive reserve, which is basically the idea that, you know, if you had a large toolkit and you had lots and lots of tools, and then someone went around, you know, age perhaps, and just stole some of those tools from your toolkit, you know, which can happen if the, you know, the brain starts to deteriorate or decay as you get older, and you lost some of those tools, but you had a lot of other tools, you would have this cognitive reserve and you would be better able to perform daily life tasks, because if one of your tools is missing, you'd go and you'd grab one of the other ones that also works. And so again, this isn't to say that there's nothing we can do to keep ourselves sharp as we get older. It's just that the idea is that we want to have that breadth. But of course, you know, in the case of your grandmother, I don't want to make this a morality play. I think it is quite a shame that some people do have neurodegenerative diseases, and it's certainly not their fault that they've gotten those.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many factors that play into that. It was just one of those things that I think stood out to us, because we felt like she was doing the work, you know, but it wasn't working. But this brings up an interesting question, and I'm not even sure if you addressed it in the book so much, but so you're talking about having a lot of different tools that we can access, learning a lot of different kinds of information. So I think it's sort of a personality thing, maybe in some ways. Like some of us go like an inch deep in 1,000 different subjects, and some of us go really deep into just one or two different things. Is there evidence of one being better for us, or does that really matter? Or is it just like, how does that work?
I mean, this is an almost a philosophical question, so it's hard to say that like, oh, there's going to be some study that finds out that the specialists are better. I think there's a couple different ways of looking at it. So one thing we know is that the individual little pieces of knowledge that you acquire tend to have like fairly limited scope. And I mean, I'm using a fairly vague verbiage there. There's certainly some ideas that are really, and skills that are really general. Like learning to read is such a general skill that people, students who learn to read, and they learn to read better when they're younger, that actually boosts their IQ later, presumably because as you read more books, you get smarter. So there are some skills that are super important, super general. So I don't want to make it overly the case that that's like that. But if you use a language learning context and you learn, like, you know, just to use our Spanish example, the word for water is agua, like you've learned something. And so if the word agua comes up in some situations, or there's some words that are similar to agua, and you know, like aquafina, and you're like, oh, actually it's a similar word. Like there's is some relationship there, but you kind of have to learn all those little bits and pieces. And so one of the major findings of expertise in general is how specific it is. So chess experts are not only just experts at chess, so that they, you know, their knowledge is kind of contained within the domain of chess, but even their sort of superior abilities to remember what's on the board. I don't know if you've ever seen any of these ones where like grandmasters will play blindfolded, like 9 games at a time. That was incredible. But it's really just how the brain works, that as you gain more experience, you're able to compress complicated positions into fewer and fewer pieces. So you're able to keep all of those things in mind at the same time. Because for you, it's like you're listening to 9 different stories, as opposed to for me or you or someone who maybe doesn't have a lot of chess experience, it's just a lot of pieces and it's hard to keep track of it. But interestingly, this enhanced ability to do recall, which is well documented, not just in chess, but in other areas of expertise, it drops dramatically, even in a chessboard where you just scramble it up. So if the story doesn't make sense anymore, the story of the chess game is something you just, you know, randomly iterate, then they're not able to recall much better than novices. And so this shows that like what the knowledge is doing, what the skill is doing is quite specific. So that's sort of a vote in favor of being more specialized, particularly in the things where you really want to excel. So if you are really trying to become an Olympic sprinter, or you're really trying to become like the best accountant in the world, like focusing on that skill itself is probably going to reap the highest dividends. But there's a, you know, to get to the philosophical point of it, you know, we're not just trying to do one thing in our life. We're trying to do lots of things. And sometimes if you become overly specialized in one skill, you kind of are really, really good at one thing, and then the world changes and that thing isn't desirable anymore. And then you're stuck. You're not sure what to do. So I think probably the right approach is to have a bit of both, that you want to be broad. You want to have the kind of like broad education so that like you understand the news, you understand what things are going on. You can pick up conversations from people who are like not in your specialty. And then you also want to specialize a little bit so you can, you know, fit into the productive sphere of human society and do something that's good and really useful. And so there's a little bit of a balancing act there, but I think both are important.
Yeah. I thought this was really interesting when you bring up golf in the book for a couple of different reasons. Sure. But one is that I have gotten into golf fairly recently. And so I'm like,
you'll have to check my chapter then.
No, it was like right on. And it was something my dad is incredibly good at golf. Okay. And we want to talk about somebody who's gone deep like that. Yeah. That is his thing. And so I almost have to tell people like when I meet them at golf courses, like, yes, that is my last name, but no, I do not have that ability. Like, don't have that expectation. But he was saying to me, like, you're going to enjoy the game of golf so much more if when you're out there playing, you don't have to think about all the mechanics of it. And you kind of talk about this in your book, that if you're able to switch to focusing on the goal rather than focusing on the mechanics, then you're able to, I don't know, be better at it. Or how would you synthesize that information?
Yeah, so there's some interesting research surrounding what's the best way to teach movement skills, like golf would be one of them. And one of the findings from this literature is that when people have an external focus, so they're focusing on the goal of the movement, broadly speaking, they tend to do better and they tend to learn the skill better than when you focus on like, you know, this is what your muscles are doing, or this is what your body's doing. And I think part of that is just that a lot of the conscious mind is not really fully paying attention to the details of how the movement's implemented. Like if I say, okay, go grab that thing, you're not thinking, okay, now I must flex my tricep. Like you're not thinking that. You just instinctively do whatever seems to be the most, you know, efficient way to accomplish that goal. And so there's some evidence that like in the brain, when you're making these decisions, the sort of like the part where you're saying like that you're conscious of is a little bit like, do this. And then there's sort of like this cascade to these lower motor centers where they're actually figuring out like the incredibly complicated set of muscles you need to do and feedback you need to coordinate to actually do that movement. So I think there is some benefit of that. The disadvantage though, is because we're not conscious of a lot of the movement patterns, you can do bad movement patterns and like have bad habits. And so good coaches, they often know how to walk this line between giving you just enough conscious feedback so you can avoid doing something that would feel like the natural thing to do, but is a bad habit. But not so much information that you're like micromanaging what should be this sort of unconscious process. So, you know, like good coaches are sort of like, you know, like pretend you're swinging it like this and then you're not really like focusing on the swing, but you just have like one piece of advice that you're focusing on and it shifts you to the right motor pattern. So I do think coaching motor skills is different in a lot of ways than teaching more intellectual skills, where I think intellectual skills really do benefit from being quite explicit and breaking down all the components. But motor skills, you have to kind of walk this fine line between you know, giving them enough advice so that they can do something correctly, but not so much that they're just overwhelmed and then they're doing like really weird things that they wouldn't ever do naturally, you know?
Yeah. Kind of how it ends up when I'm getting a coaching session from my dad. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. Stop.
Yeah. That's a problem. You know, a lot of people who are experts, particularly in motor skills, they very easily overwhelm you with like, do this and this and this, but don't do this and do this. And you're just like, you can't process it, right?
Well, and I thought it was interesting how you talked about Tiger Woods changing his swing, and that we don't really have this ability to make tweaks to things like that. Like, it's kind of like basically having to start over again and work through that entire learning process. I mean, to a certain extent.
I mean, so that's also an interesting area of research of like, how much does the skill have to change to when you're learning a new skill versus modifying an existing skill? So there's this like entire theory of like motor programs, which is just sort of like, well, what parts of the skill are, you know, hardwired? So like, if you learn it to do it a different way, it's a new skill versus you're modifying it. So like, one of my favorite examples of that is like writing your signature. So if you write your signature on a checkbook versus you write it on a blackboard, you don't really think about it because you do the same signature, but actually you're using totally different muscles. Because when you're dealing with the checkbook, you're using your wrist, whereas you do it with the other one, you're using your shoulder, but somehow it's still your signature, right? It's not someone else's signature. So how can that be? So the idea is that there is some flexibility in the motor program. So if you're doing something, there's a lot of variables that you are able to change. So you're able to change the intensity, you're able to change the speed. Sometimes for like precision skills, you can change the target. So if you're throwing a ball, for instance, you can change where you're trying to hit it. These are all things that seem to be modifiable under the same skill. So they're just tweaks to an existing skill. But one of the things is like relative timing. So if you're doing like a dance move or something, and it's like slow, slow, fast, 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 slow, slow, fast, 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 and then you go fast, 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 and you're trying to do the same movement, it's really hard because the timing, it looks like, is baked in. So there seems to be some aspects that are kind of rigid. And certainly if we're talking about like completely different movements, they're probably different skills. So if you're thinking about like typing on a keyboard with, you know, two fingers, hand and back, versus touch typing, those are probably different skills. And so one of the difficulties is that if you have a well-learned motor program that achieves the goal, like at least sort of well some of the time, your tendency is going to be to use that because that's the most efficient option for you. And so if you're trying to find a new way of doing something because you think it's going to be superior, this can be a fraught process because not only do you have to like completely learn a new skill up from the beginning, do all the practice to make it automatic again, but then you also have to like try to suppress the old skills. So, and sometimes that can happen. So, you know, in golf, a lot of people who have tried to change their swing in dramatic ways, that was often the difficulty, is that when they would be under pressure situations, the old way of doing it would come up when they don't want it, and then it would result in them missing the shot. So I don't want to say that like most of the time this is what we need to do, is like totally relearn things from scratch, but it is sometimes something that we're doing. So there's lots of skills where we have to kind of, you know, go back down in our ability and start back up again if we're trying to make new levels of performance.
Yeah. Well, and you talk about this when you're talking about like jazz musicians learning how to improvise and people being able to have like those iterations of things. You talk a lot about like inventors who have obviously gone very deep into one subject, and how that proliferation can actually make you more productive. I thought that was an interesting thing. Like, usually the people who are the best at things are the people who have poured the most into them. How do we apply that?
Sure. So I'll talk about the point you made where I have a chapter called Quality Comes from Quantity. And this was coming from what I thought was a really interesting body of research done by the psychologist Dean Simonton, where he basically found that, and this has been something that's been replicated, you know, it goes back even before Simonton's research, but he did a lot of the work on it, where if you look at the amount of work a creator produces, so the amount of papers a psychologist published, the amount of, you know, songs a composer writes, so this kind of thing, the amount of work is strongly correlated with like their overall impact in their field. And he has this idea he calls the equal odds baseline, which suggests that there's just a certain amount of inescapable randomness in doing creative work, doing something that's sort of at the frontier. We're not talking about routine problem solving, but like you're trying to make an invention or compose a song or, you know, have a best-selling book. And because of this random element, the people who produce the most, who are the most prolific, tend to be the ones that have the most hits. And there's some exceptions to this. There are some people who seem to be like, you know, they churn out mediocre stuff. And there's some people that really do master a particular one, but the trend line generally holds. And so I think that's something that's very interesting, because we often think about, I think, creativity in these sort of quasi-mystical terms, when, you know, the brute force approach to it may actually be closer to the reality for most working scientists and artists.
Yeah, I hear that from so many people, like writers who will get writer's block, and they're like, I just set a timer and I just force myself to start writing, even if I'm just writing, I don't know what to write and I just need to write something down, because eventually it like gets that muscle moving so that you actually can produce something. But I think I know I have struggled with it. I know a lot of people do, like this whole idea of imposter syndrome where you hold back because something's not perfect or you don't feel like you're going to get it right. And maybe the answer is like, just start putting the stuff out there. It's like that whole idea of messy action, of something is better than nothing.
Well, this is related to the other chapter that I have on anxiety and the relationship between like fear and learning, because for a lot of us, it's not just our, you know, desire to be good at something, but we often have these fears that hold us back from practicing. You know, I think writer's block is, you know, the kind of imposter syndrome you talked about. It's very much an anxiety thing, right? It's very much like you're feeling anxious and it's impeding you from doing the work. Cause like, well, if I go out there and I do this thing and I put my work out there, people are going to call me a fraud. They're going to say that, like, you shouldn't be doing this and this is terrible and blah, blah, blah. And all these negative social repercussions are going to happen and I'm going to feel bad. And so because of that, we hold back. Either we don't do the work or we spend like all these sort of moments perseverating over our anxiety rather than doing the work, and it slows us down. So I found it very interesting that in this base of like research on anxiety, one of the most effective ways to deal with people who have elevated anxiety is exposure therapy, which is basically you expose yourself to the thing that you're afraid of. And then when you kind of in doing so realize like nothing really bad is going to happen, it will lower your fear. And not just sort of from, you know, because I can even say, oh, well, if I'm going to publish a book and then like it's just going to have all these negative reviews from all these important people, it's pretty easy to articulate like why that's maybe implausible. Like the most likely outcome if I write something really bad is just people ignore it, you know, this kind of thing. But this fear is not just intellectual. There's circuitry in the brain that is probably unconscious, and it controls whether or not we feel these threats. And so this is sort of like bubbling up in our conscious mind. So that anxiety in some cases is not something that we can just, you know, well, that's irrational, so I won't do that.
Yeah.
But if you experience the actual situation, the cause of the fear, and again, nothing really bad happens, you learn at this sort of unconscious level, these patterns of safety that suppress some of that fear circuitry. And so, I mean, this, the probably the best example of this is if you've ever done something like if you have a little bit of fear of heights and then you've had to be up on high place for a while. Like I can recall an instance where there was a few months where I was living in a very high, it was like on the 20th floor condo that had floor to ceiling glass windows. If you stood by the edge of the window, it was pretty high up. I remember there was this sort of like a little bit of an elevated heart rate of like, oh, okay. And, you know, for the first day or two, it was like a little bit, oh, wow, okay, where I'm pretty high up. And then by the end of like the month, you're just totally ignore it. It's just totally normal. And so this isn't, you know, me, like I know the glass is there. I know I'm not like going to fall out of the window. But the sort of unconscious circuitry is not that smart. So it's not able to figure that out. But if I experience it and I'm like, oh, I actually didn't drop to my death. I'm experiencing this repeatedly. You learn this safety and it suppresses that natural reaction. So this is, I think, an important mechanism to understand, because I think very often when we're considering things like writing, public speaking, speaking another language, we very much project our fear out onto the thing. So it's like, it's not that I have this fear response to this thing. It's that that thing is just objectively scary, right?
Yeah.
It's just objectively scary. And that's just how it is. And I think sometimes it's useful to realize, but yes, but if you did do it regularly, it would feel normal. And that's, I think, the harder thing to like sell yourself on sometimes.
Yeah. I think so. And I think we have so many of those things in our lives that we just don't realize that other people are like, oh, I could never do that. But they just, they end up feeling very regular. And so you just, you figure out how to do it. So it's that pushing through so that you can get there. Now, I want to kind of come into a little bit more of like the learning space as far as like studying and things that we can bring to our kids going into the school year and stuff like that, because you talk about some of these different study methods that we have utilized over the years and what's effective and what's not. You talk a lot about variability and repetition and review. And so would you give us like a snapshot on that? Like, what can we tell our kids going into the school year to focus on and how to maybe change things up so that they can be more successful?
Yeah, well, probably the best advice, aside from just, having your stuff together and you setting aside time to study, all the stuff that I think most people probably already know about. In terms of you're actually sitting down at the books and studying, what's the best tip I could give to a student to improve their studying advice? It would be to practice retrieval rather than review. And this is a sort of subtle point that I think a lot of people don't always get right away. So if you look at the average high school college student and see what they're doing when they're studying for an exam, a good proportion of it is looking over their notes. And even if they're not just literally rereading, sometimes they're recopying, they've got the multicolored highlighters, they're making little
That's
diagrams and stuff.
me. Yeah.
They're doing stuff like that. But the key feature is that they're looking at the book, they're looking at the information, and then they're doing something with it. So this idea comes from a lot of work that shows that actually, if you close the book and you try to remember from in your head what was in the content, you try to retrieve it from your memory, this strengthens the memory a lot more than looking over your notes. So this, I think, is probably one of the biggest things that you can do to improve your studying as a student, and one of the best advice piece of advice you can give your kids if they're trying to study, that if they want to study more efficiently, meaning this is not just like a way of doing it right and it's harder and this kind of thing, although
Yeah.
it often is harder, but if you want to spend less time and get the same kind of benefit in terms of your improved memories, you want to practice retrieval. Now, this can be done very simply. You just close the book and you have a blank piece of paper and you write down everything that you can remember. That's called free recall. But sometimes that is not always the most efficient because trying to recall the contents of an entire textbook with a blank page is often difficult. So there's a few ways that you can do that are better. So the best way is probably to do practice questions that are close to the test that you're going to have to do. That's probably the best kind of practice. So if you're in a math class, doing the math questions without having the answers right there while you're doing them is a good way of doing it because you get some practice doing it, get practice retrieving. Doing it. If you have to do like essay topics, just sort of take the headers from whatever you were trying to study and then try to recreate what the argument of that chapter or that section was on paper. Flashcards are another good thing if you have to memorize specific information. So vocabulary in a foreign language, your periodic table elements, things like that. There's a lot of that stuff in high school and college. And so having your flashcards is another way of doing it because it's on one side and not the other. So you flip it over. And so I think the more you can get in the habit of practicing retrieval instead of review while you're studying, meaning after you've presumably read the text and you attended the classes, this is going to be give you the most bang for your buck in terms of studying.
Okay, I think that is really helpful because I was that kid who did the color coding and the rewriting and it worked for me for the most part. I mean, I got good grades and I did well, but I think that's such an interesting idea, especially for somebody like my son has dyslexia. And so for him, even the act of trying to review notes is there's a major hurdle there. Even the taking of the notes is a lot for him. But for him to go in there, he's a very auditory learner. And so to be able to kind of process through the things in that way and that being a very legitimate form of studying, I think is really helpful.
I mean, the more you can practice the thing that you're going to be doing on the test, I think the better off you're going to be. And I think there's a sort of idea that the test is a way, mostly a way, like if we have quizzes or tests or even homework, it's mostly a way of like assessing, like, did you learn it? Like, were you actually paying attention in class? And while it can be for that, I think that really underrates the power of testing because taking the test makes you better at the test. And so I think if the more you can think in the terms of that practice metaphor, I think you'll get more efficient studying because I think that's the way to sell it to your kids. Not like, oh, you need to be doing this, like you need to be like flossing your teeth and folding your laundry. It has to be, instead of spending 2 hours doing this, you could spend, an hour and a half or an hour doing this other thing and get the same results. And so I think that's a win-win for everyone.
And it's more long term too, because so much of the time when you're just doing that quick review, it's just like you talk about in the book, it's just to cram it for the test and then it's pretty much gone. But if you can kind of commit it to a deeper memory from that recall, I think that's more the point of doing school in the first place anyway. Makes it a little bit more worthwhile.
Well, I mean, that's another thing too, is that the typical student habit of doing most your studying right before the exam is less efficient in terms of making long-term memories than sort of spreading it out throughout the semester or throughout the term. So, I mean, that's maybe a little harder to sell students on than the retrieval practice idea, just because cramming right before the test does boost your performance, like right before the test.
Yeah.
So if all you cared about was passing the test, then cramming is not like a terrible strategy. It's just really bad if you have like another class after it that uses information.
Yeah.
So I think it's just that's the challenge that we have is, you know, there's some strategies for learning, I think, like retrieval, that I think if you can explain why they work and why they kind of are deceptive, they could, it doesn't appear like they really work, but there's lots of research showing that they work, it's easier to sell kids on them. But there's other things like spacing, which are sometimes harder because it is this sort of long-term, short-term trade-off that, you know, teenagers are not always the best at.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, hopefully as they're getting into college a little bit more, yeah, they're wanting to take advantage of those things, because they're hopefully going to be things they're like applying to their career and wanting
hopefully,
to keep
yes,
in that long-term memory. Mm-hmm. Now, also, you talk about the idea of variability over repetition, like having things be changing and applying them to different situations. How is there a way to apply that to, yeah, studying or school or what? How do
oh,
we
definitely. Yeah. So the basic idea is that, as with retrieval, where it's something that when you're doing it, it feels harder, but it's actually better for learning. Like it seems like when you close the book and try to remember stuff, you're like, I don't remember anything. This is such a waste of time. But it's actually better than you rereading it in most cases, right? Because that effort to try to retrieve the memory makes it better. So another example would be variability. So if you are, let's say, doing questions from a math class, and there's like, you know, 8 units in the math class, it's much easier to do all unit 1 questions and then all unit 2 questions and all unit 3 questions. Or like if you're learning a language, it's like, okay, we're going to do this conjugation now. And then you do like 15 of that conjugation in a row. And then you do another one and you do 15 in a row. That's easier, right? But the research shows that if you were to mix them up, so if you were to scramble them, so you're not just practicing unit 1, you're practicing all the different units, you're going back and forth. This has 2 effects. So one effect is that it tends to make the memories more durable so that you will have longer retention. But interestingly, it makes it so that you're better able to learn new stuff faster within the domain. So if you give people sort of one of the first experiments that did this with motor skills, where they like had people learn some kind of sequence where they had to like knock over these things in a certain order. And they had people trained in this sort of what's called a blocked fashion, where you like do one sequence, you know, 15 times, and then you do the other sequence 15 times. Or they did a random fashion where it was sort of like, okay, sequence 1, sequence 2, sequence 2, sequence 1, sequence 1, sequence 2, and going back and forth. And what was interesting is that when they did sequence 3 or 4, which they'd never seen before, the people who did the random practice actually learned it faster. Hmm. And it seems that like this exposure to variability, to mixing things up, helps in a couple of ways. And one is with sort of deciding when to use certain knowledge, which is a really important part of learning. And it also maybe allows you to learn things at a somewhat more abstract level so that you're better able to generalize it to new situations. So, I mean, the knocking over wooden blocks in a certain order may seem kind of ridiculous and not very realistic, but it's actually like not that far apart from like what you do when you, let's say, play the piano, right? You're pressing keys in a certain order. That's how you play the piano. And so the idea here is that while playing the same part of the same song over and over and over again will temporarily make you better at that one thing, if you want to be a generally good piano player, mixing it up is probably beneficial.
I think that's really helpful too, because like you were saying, it can apply to so many things, whether or not it's studying for a test, but learning things in general, especially if you want to have them go deeper and be able to utilize them, like language and that kind of thing. I think it's so beneficial to be incorporating some of those ideas and maybe shaking up the way that you've been doing your learning in those things.
Absolutely.
Up until now. Yeah. So if you had to pick out of everything that you learned in this book, everything you synthesized, like what is your favorite part or your favorite takeaway from writing this book?
Oh, geez. I don't know. Well, it I feel like when I was compiling this book, it was just a long succession of like, oh, that's interesting. And you dig deeper. And so the book is sort of like my notes of what I thought was interesting on this. So I did not make the kind of, you know, I didn't like choose to write a textbook, let's say, where you're like, okay, we're going to like start off from the very basics. I did try to focus on things that I thought were, you know, not as commonly appreciated or thought were more interesting. And I mean, I already mentioned, I think one of my favorite chapters is the one on fear and anxiety, because I think that one is really important, really practical. The research is very clear on that. And it's also one that I think has a big impact because, you know, while we can talk about variable practice and retrieval for students, I mean, we all deal with fears and anxieties, and they can sometimes dominate the quality of our life. So I think that one's very important. The other one that I thought was really interesting was the sort of evolution of pilot training. So I have a chapter where I kind of talk about sort of two stories that go back and forth between Major Smith Barry, who was one of the first military pilot trainers sort of in the World War I, and how like many of the ideas we have about like the right way to teach those kinds of skills originated with him. And then also the situation that we find ourselves in now, where almost no commercial aviation accidents occur because like of, you know, just raw ability to pilot the plane. Instead, there are communication errors, someone doesn't know someone's on the tarmac, and this can have sometimes devastating consequences. And so this sort of evolution of skill learning kind of mirrors a lot of what has gone on in the research, where the focus, you know, to this day, but very much in the initial period, was very focused on these kind of like very narrow skills that people were acquiring in narrow kind of training. And the issue is that when you're doing and performing skills in real life, there's all these interactions with other people, with the environment, and this affects your ability to do the job. So if you are trying to learn a skill, there's certainly a lot you can learn in the classroom, but there's a lot that you need to be in the workplace actually doing it to learn it because of these interactions. So I thought that was very interesting, and I enjoyed being able to tell those stories because I liked them when I heard them.
Yeah, for sure. And it's so true. Like we can do all of this book work learning as much as we want, but until we start to put it into practice. I mean, I think people who are farther along in their lives and well out of school, like you definitely experience that. Like, oh, it was one thing in writing and in the book, but actually doing it and having to communicate with other people and synthesize all those things, it's a very different experience. So
Absolutely.
well, I think you did a great job with this book. It was
Oh,
so
thank you.
incredibly interesting to read. There were so many different references to people and inventors and musicians, and I just it was constantly changing and interesting. So I hope that people will grab this book and really allow it to help them and their kids and whoever in their life to learn things better, because you do a really good
Oh,
job with
thank you
it.
so much.
Yeah. So would you like to tell us what a typical day looks like for you?
Well, I mean, my typical day changes. I work for myself, and so it often depends a lot on the project I'm working on. So, like when I was working on this book, I was reading a lot, unsurprisingly. I mean, now these days, my day, I usually wake up around 6. I exercise, either go to the gym or go for a run. And then I've got small kids at home, so mine are a little younger than yours. I've got a 4.5-year-old and a 1.5-year-old, so they're keeping us busy until it's time for work. And then, I work during the day these days. It's more writing, reading, and also having nice conversations with people like you. And and then I go home, we make dinner, the kids go to bed, read a few books, and usually go to sleep. And then, you know, on the weekends and stuff, I like to do some like you go out, you can have dinner at a restaurant, things like that as well. So I don't know, pretty simple life, but I feel like I've got a good rhythm for
As much as you can have a rhythm with kids that young,
it. Yeah, yeah.
right? They're
They
always
keep they
throwing.
keep they keep you grounded. I feel like you kind of crave the sort of simpler life when you have kids because they introduce that element of chaos into it. So
My
you don't
youngest
seek
is
it out as much.
oh, it's for sure. My youngest is now 9, and so it's like finally like, oh, wait a minute. Like maybe I can have a little bit of my own life here. I can start doing stuff. Like you guys are kind of self-sufficient. This is great.
Some mom told me this quote where she's like, when you can leave your kid in the other room and not worry that they're going to die, the second part of your life begins. So definitely that early phase, you're like, oh, don't do that, don't touch that. You know, you can get into that, but it's such a joy because they are learning machines. They are changing all the time, and so just I think that's, you know, maybe the biggest inspiration of all to keep learning is watching your kids.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Just wait till the next best phase that comes is that when one of them can drive and then take the other one to where they need to go. Then it's like,
Yeah, I'm gonna
oh,
have to
I'm
work on
home
my
free.
exposure therapy when they're behind the wheel, I
For sure. For
think.
sure. Okay, what is one little way that you live well anyway in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think one habit that I've gotten into, which I think everyone could benefit from, is always have a book with you. So that could be on your phone, you can get the Kindle app. If you like audiobooks, Audible's great. I have no qualms against that. I think it's great to listen to books too. And keep a paper book by your bedside so you can like read for like 5, 10 minutes before bed. It's really good for like getting yourself to settle down. And in general, not just because I'm an author who has books to sell, but in general, I think being someone who reads more is good. We get a lot of our content, a lot of our information in this sort of like highly fractionated, hyper emotional kind of way these days. And I don't want to say that, that's okay in moderation, but I feel like, the joy of like sitting down, listening to a book, especially if it's nonfiction, where you're, hopefully listening to someone who's spent a few years pouring their concentrated thinking into a single topic. I mean, you just kind of can't get that from like an Instagram post or a TikTok video. So I would highly recommend, making that step so that the reading is available, so it can compete a little better against all the other things that we have to distract ourselves with these days.
I hope that we're kind of like coming to that point where we're going to swing back around. Like we've gone to like such short form content that people are going to be
An
like,
optimist, I
yeah,
like
like wait a minute.
it.
We need some deeper thought here again because I totally feel that. I mean, we get it from
Yeah.
the podcasts and the Instagram and everything, but when I get done like reading a book like yours, I feel so much more deeply fed and challenged and nourished and like, okay, like I've got some real stuff to work with here. And it's a very different experience that I think that more people need to be getting back on board with that. I've been trying to like force feed my kids this summer with it. Like here's Audible. Like this is an
Yeah.
amazing book that I just read. Please take in a book.
Yeah, hopefully. I have hopes too. I mean, I think ultimately the world is going to offer us a buffet of things in our life that some of them are not good for us. And you can shake your fist at the sky and be like, why are you doing this for me? But I think ultimately we have to kind of be deliberate in deciding how we want to live about all aspects of our life. And so I think the information we consume is certainly one of those areas where, just going on autopilot is not always best.
I have a question for you. This is off the
Sure.
board that I didn't
Okay.
even have written down, but
We're
you were
off
talking about
script. Okay.
reading before bed, which is something I
Yes.
do too. It's like the way that I can shut my brain down and actually be able to fall asleep.
Yeah.
But I can't do it with nonfiction because then it like
Oh, okay,
starts
yeah.
making me think more. So I'm curious what kind of reading you do before bed.
Well, I do, this isn't to say that this is ideal. I do tend to read more nonfiction than fiction. Some of that is just my own interests, and so I'm not saying that that's necessarily the ideal. I think that's something that maybe I would strive to do is read a little bit more fiction because I think that can also be very good. I don't know, for me, because I write these books and because I'm sort of in this atmosphere, I tend to read a lot more books that are like on the drier side. That was a joke a friend made. He's like, oh man, you just have this ability to like work through this like 500 page textbook on something. And so I think if you are looking to use it as a sort of like sleeping aid, then getting a nice dusty thick book that like is this is an important book that I should read is really good, because you get a couple pages and you're like, oh, it's time for bed. so
I'm done. I'm
so if
bored
you
to
want to get
tears.
like Yeah, like get a copy of like Milton's Paradise Lost and just like keep it by your bedside. And if you get through it in the next 3 years, then that'll, you'll have some good rest at least.
That's funny. That's a good tip. I
Yeah.
know somebody who listens to like English history, like British
Yeah.
monarch history, and she just puts it in. She has like a headband that she wears that
Yeah,
has
yeah.
earbuds in it, and she slows it down too, where I always listen to
Slows
my
it down,
audiobooks
yeah.
fast, but she
Yeah,
slows
yeah.
it down so it'll just like make her drift off.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's like the audiobook thing, like, 'cause now I think Audible, they have that, they know people are doing this. They have that feature that has the timer. So like if you fall asleep in the middle, it'll like shut off after a while. So I don't know. Yeah, I find that listening is also a good thing to do too, because if you like, especially if you're like trying to relax and you don't want so much lighting, or your partner is sleeping or something like this, it can be helpful as well. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, are you ready for my stock questions?
Okay, I'm ready.
All right. Some of these are, I feel like, I hope they're not like too femaley focused. I don't think they are. Maybe the first one, but candles or essential oil diffuser?
Well, yes, I am stereotypically male in that sense that I don't have a lot of things like that, but I do like candles. I would say I prefer candles to the diffuser. Yeah.
Okay. Cloth napkins or paper?
I hate to admit that I'm more of a paper napkin person in my day-to-day life, and I feel almost sheepish admitting that because I obviously would be better if we wash things and not throw them in the garbage
Yeah, but you also have a 1-year-old and a 4-year-old, so a
There's a
little bit
lot,
of
we go through a
reality.
lot of paper towel. We get the Costco size. Not gonna lie.
Okay, city or country?
I'm more of a city person, but I grew up in, well, town, but like in the wilderness. Maybe the wilderness is better than the country. And so I feel like, I don't know, I feel like I'm one of those rebel people that like I spent the first 20 years of my life living like in the middle of nowhere. And so now I live in a bit more of an urban environment.
Okay, I'm right there with you. All right, paper or digital?
Oh, well. Both. I mean, I feel like there's nothing like holding a book. There's nothing like writing handwritten notes, but definitely there are some advantages to digital. Like when I was researching my first book, I decided I was going to print out all the papers and like, because I prefer reading them that way. And it turned out that was a nightmare when you had to like find them later because they'd have these big stacks of binders and I'm like, oh, which binder is it in? And so this book, I didn't do that. And I'm glad I didn't because I would have had like my entire office would have been full of printed off papers. We'd had to have fell a small forest to get all of those things printed out.
There are advantages to the search feature, just being able
There
to
are,
find
there are. Even
something.
though the experience of reading is generally better with paper, I think.
Okay, shopping. Would you rather do it online or in the store?
Oh, I'm an efficiency person, so usually online. Although I do think with groceries and some, you know, staples, it's nice to go there because I prefer to like actually, you know, squeeze the fruit as it is.
Yeah, my mom says the same thing. She's like, I can't
Yeah.
trust anyone to pick out the produce that I
Yeah.
want.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, it's whatever time you're making dinner and you need a mental break. Do you listen to a podcast or music?
Oh, well, usually when we're making dinner, the kids are scurrying about, so it's definitely music because you know, they're gonna be having a little dance party where you're like chopping vegetables and stuff. I think if it was just myself, which is hard to even imagine, I have to like really get outside of my own life right now to imagine this. But if there were some circumstance where I was making dinner for myself, probably audiobook, I think I would lean toward that if it's just me, but you know, I need to be able to pay attention. And between kids, cooking, and audiobook,
Yeah, that's a
I'm not
lot.
going to be absorbing any information from the latter.
Okay, chocolate, milk or dark?
Dark.
Okay.
I'm yeah. I'm like darker the better. You know, give me that 90% chocolates. That's the best. Yeah.
That's good. All right, sports or no sports?
I'd like more sports. I'm not particularly good at sports, so my athletic interests tend to be the less like, you know, football, basketball, more like skiing and like climbing or things where it's like, you know, a little bit less dexterity required. But I feel like being physically active, being involved in like having kind of athletic hobbies, I think especially for people like me that are more bookish and less athletic, it's important because I think especially as you get out of school, you get busy with working kids, it's very easy to, you know, realize that, oh, actually I've let my physical condition deteriorate in ways that are bad for my body and mind.
I've been sedentary for the past week.
Yes,
I
yes.
need to move.
Yeah.
Okay, live broadcasting, like doing Instagram stories or being on a podcast, would you rather listen or do the
Like be the
broadcasting?
guest,
Yeah,
be the guest.
or like do
Yeah,
Instagram stories.
I would say I'm usually like if I count up the amount of podcasts I've been on versus the amount that I listen to, I definitely go on more than I listen. But I think that's just usually because I tend toward like audiobooks. There are some podcasts that are really good and I will listen to them, but I feel like I kind of like the, oh, you've really thought about what words you're going to put together as opposed to the informal conversation. But I can understand they fill different roles for people. So that's not a judgment against podcasts. I think if you're listening to podcasts and you're getting good information from them, it's just a personal preference.
And sometimes they're just for entertainment, if I'm
Yeah,
being real.
of course. Yeah. They're just in the background where you're chopping up vegetables while your kids scurry about, right?
Doesn't matter if my kids interrupt me if I'm listening to an entertainment podcast.
Right.
Okay, what is your favorite movie?
Oh, favorite movie. Oh, that's a hard one. I this is maybe The Matrix, the original Matrix movie, one of my
Okay.
favorite movies. I really enjoy that movie. I've actually watched it. I go back to it every once in a while. It's a well-made movie.
And there's things about those movies that have held up really well over time that I think are impressive, even as far as the graphics go and stuff for
Just
some
has,
of it.
yeah, I mean, everyone focused on the bullet time when it came out, but it's just a very well-constructed story. Like, it doesn't, especially compared to the other ones that came after, it doesn't make a lot of mistakes in terms of the storytelling, which I can't be said for a lot of movies.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. Okay, and final question. If you were
Okay.
to put yourself on the crunchiness spectrum, where zero is totally not crunchy and 10 is like singing Kumbaya by the fire with your
Oh.
hair in dreadlocks, where are you on the spectrum?
Oh, yeah, that's hard to say. I don't feel like I'm that crunchy, but I mean, I've been like sort of vegetarian for like last 20 years, so maybe I'm more crunchy than I realize. I don't know. I'm about in the middle, maybe.
Okay.
I'm definitely not getting dreads, but I
Yeah.
feel like you know, yeah, I've definitely had those people long conversations about
Yeah.
oneness. So I maybe
All
I'm more
right.
crunchy than I'd like to think I am.
A lot of people who are don't rate
Don't
themselves
realize how
very
crunchy
high.
they are.
Yeah,
Yeah, don't realize how
exactly.
crunchy they are. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it was so great having you on today, Scott.
Oh,
Thank
thank
you
you.
so much for coming on and talking about learning. And I hope your next Spanish podcast goes really well.
Thank you very much.
All right. That is it for this week's episode. I hope that you found it really interesting and maybe helpful for either something you're studying or teaching your kids to be able to study better, and just for all of us to be able to have those skills to be able to learn well and keep our brains fresh as we're getting older. I thought what he had to say was so interesting, and I hope that you did too. If you want to find the show notes for this show or any other episode that we've ever had, you can go to mackenziekoppa.com and click on podcast, or you can swipe up in whatever app you listen to the show on and find the notes there. Also, I have been curating my Amazon storefront slowly but surely, and I recently put up a post with all of my favorite fall nail polish colors. I've got a lot of really quick dry polishes in there and some little tips and tricks for making your fall manicure last. So if you want to find those, you can go to mackenziekoppa.com/Amazon. That will take you straight to my storefront. You'll be able to see all the different things that I recommend. I've got a lot of my favorite books in there, and I'm continuing to update that. I'm also planning on going live in my Amazon storefront to talk about some of my favorite things. I'm going to be covering different health products and, of course, nail polish and books and all that good stuff. So make sure you're following me on Amazon so that you can stay up to date on all those things. All right, ladies, thank you so much for joining me this week. Until next week, go be bold and gracious.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.